You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Dr. Roberts, thanks for joining us today.
Dave, thank you.
Sir, it is really a distinct honor and privilege to speak with you. I've been reading your stuff for many years, and I'm sure that most of the listeners know who you are, as people who are attracted to these type of broadcasts are familiar with you. But I do want to, for the benefit of those listeners who might not be, and for the benefit of the listeners who don't know much about you as far as your background, I'd like to get into that. And there are various bio sketches of you across the internet, and I just want to look at this one in particular. It says, Paul Craig Roberts was a Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and the Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal, columnist for Business Week, Scripps, Howard News Service, and Creator Syndicate, and you have had many university appointments. Is that correct right there?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, good. And of course, if we go to Wikipedia, which is a great site for basic information, of course, when you get to the more quote-unquote controversial stuff, you'll find that Wikipedia actually censors material. I wrote an article about that, how they censored the information on Larry Silverstein. And when he gave the order to demolish Building 7, Wikipedia still does not allow that up there. So it's depriving millions and millions of folks across the world the ability to accurately assess what happened on 9/11. So I am issuing that warning to the listeners who aren't aware of that. Hopefully there's a lot who are. But I want to go to this Wikipedia page. And of course, they mentioned what I just read. And you had served under President Reagan as the United States Assistant Secretary of Treasury for Economic Policy. Dr. Roberts, what exactly is the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy?
Well, it depends on the administration and the person. In my case, I was the point man in the president's government, in the executive branch, for getting his economic program out of his own government so that the Congress could vote for it. So my job was to get what the press began calling Reaganomics out of the president's own government, out of the Treasury, out of the Council of Economic Advisers, and out of the Office of Management and Budget, and also out of the Chief of Staff of the White House. This was a big job because the Chief of Staff was James Baker, a member of the Republican establishment, not a Reaganite, and he was more sensitive to establishment views of things than of major changes. Stockman had his own agenda and was a totally unreliable supporter of the president's program. And so it was a big fight within the government. But I succeeded and got the program out of the administration into the Congress, where it passed. And it had a lot of support from the Senate Democrats. And in the final inning, the House Democrats had their own version of the president's program. So it was how supply-side economics became the policy instead of the post-World War II Keynesian demand management. That was my job in the Treasury. I later had other assignments, but that was what I did. Now, I would imagine this post would be less important if there's no major economic policy debate, no effort to make some fundamental change in the way things are going. But when I was there, it was really the center of the president's economic policy.
Mm-hmm. What type of a fella, I imagine you had regular interactions with Ronald Reagan. What type of a fella did you feel he was? What did you come away after hanging out with him the many times you did?
I came away with the opinion that there were only two issues that were important to him, and they were related. And one was the economy, because it was suffering from what was called at the time stagflation. The post-war Keynesian policy had broken down. They had always used a bit of inflation to encourage more employment. And when inflation got out of hand, they would use unemployment to control the inflation. But those trade-offs were worsening through time, and you were having to pay a higher and higher price in terms of inflation in order to boost employment a bit, and you were having to pay a higher and higher price in unemployment in order to lower inflation a bit. And this policy, no one had a solution to except the supply-side economists. Well, Reagan wanted to fix the economy because he knew the Soviet economy was in dire conditions, and he reasoned that if he could rescue our economy so that it functioned again, he would be in a strong position to threaten the Soviet government with an arms race. and that they wouldn't be able to match that threat because of the serious economic conditions in the Soviet Union. And so he wanted to use the threat of an arms race to force them to negotiate the end of the Cold War, because Reagan really was opposed to what he called those god-awful nuclear weapons. Patrick Buchanan, who was in the White House with him and was at Reykjavik with him, has given precisely the same account. So Reagan wanted to fix the economy and he wanted to end the Cold War. Those are literally the only two issues he paid any attention to. I also noted he had a very withdrawn management style. He was very non-confrontational with the people in his government who were really not supporting him. So that Don Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary, and I, we would go over to meetings at the White House trying to get the president's program out of his own government. The president would make a decision. He would say, "I agree with the Treasury," and get up and leave the room. And as soon as he left the room, Jim Baker would turn to us and say, "Can't the Treasury make a better case?" And Don Regan couldn't figure out why President Reagan hadn't fired Jim Baker and David Stockman. He felt like this really wasn't working the way it was supposed to. President would take our side, and yet we would be sent back to the drawing table and have to make the same case all over again. So I think that's my image of him. He just relied on us to get it done. Mm-hmm. He wasn't confrontational toward people who weren't serving him well. And I told you what his two real concerns were. And he achieved both of them. And he doesn't get credit for this. You have to keep in mind, David, that Reagan was an outsider to the Republican establishment. You know, he defeated their candidate, which was George Herbert Walker Bush. And the establishment doesn't like to lose control. It doesn't trust outsiders. It wants to stay in the position of control, controlling the flows of influence and campaign monies and that sort of thing. And so, like Jimmy Carter was not welcomed by the Democratic establishment, and Reagan was not welcomed by the Republican establishment. Right. So even though he was very popular with the people and very pleasant guy and easy to get along with, and it wasn't a situation that was easy on the ones trying to do what he wanted.
I think a lot of people have an image of Reagan as, you know, this really dumb, "Well, go ahead." You know, there was a UK production of these puppets where they had the Reagan character going, "Well, I don't know a lot about," you know, basically it got down to how the separate branches of government operate, "but I know this, I know people." I mean, do you think he was like that? Could we say that he was that simple, that he really didn't understand the technical workings of government, but he did know people?
Oh, no, I think he very well understood government. You know, this was a guy who'd been governor of California, and he had challenged Ford for the presidential nomination. And I think he was very experienced in politics, but I think he was above politics because he had an agenda. He had something he wanted to do. And I told you what those things were. And of course, powerful interest groups were opposed to this. You know, Wall Street didn't trust the economic program because they didn't understand it. They were still trapped in Keynesian thinking. And so they misinterpreted supply side economics as an inflation program, as did Paul Volcker at the Fed. So you had this powerful Wall Street lobby that basically opposed the president's program. Now, people would say, "Oh, that couldn't be true. He was cutting their taxes." They didn't see it that way. What they saw was, "Oh, he's going to unleash inflation, destroy our stock and bond portfolios." And the CIA and the military security complex, they didn't want to end the Cold War. It's a profitable business. A lot of money there, a lot of power for the intelligence agencies. And the deep state had really prospered under the Cold War. And so here was Reagan saying he's going to end it. And they didn't like that. And in fact, the CIA told Reagan that if he started an arms race, the Soviets would win. And so he mustn't risk the United States by starting an arms race because the Soviets had a planned economy. They could invest as much of the economy as they wanted into the military, whereas Reagan couldn't. The American people wouldn't stand for it, go 5 or 6% of the GDP, but the Russians could put the whole economy into the military. And so they told him, "You can't get them to negotiate the end of the Cold War by challenging them to an arms race, because we'll lose and they'll win." And he didn't believe that. And he formed a secret committee. to which he appointed me to investigate the basis for the CIA's claim. And of course, the committee, you know, we had subpoena power over the CIA relevant documents. And the committee concluded that it was basically the CIA protecting its turf. So he went ahead and forced the issue and negotiated with Gorbachev and brought this Cold War with its threat of nuclear Armageddon to an end. He doesn't get credit for that. You know, the liberal left claim he was a warmonger who wasted all the country's money on defense and called the Soviets the evil empire. And he doesn't get credit for curing the stagflation. So he cut taxes for the rich. The rich were opposed to the tax cut. So the whole thing is a mess. He was a president who had to use the right wing's rhetoric in order to hold them together, because the right wing, the conservatives, didn't want him negotiating with Gorbachev. They said, oh, these Soviets, they're very tricky and cunning. He'll take advantage of you and we'll end up losing in these negotiations. You mustn't risk it. And of course, this type of opposition, he knew he couldn't negotiate the end of the Cold War if the conservatives and the CIA and the military security complex was against it. So he had to use the rhetoric, call them the evil empire and tear down this wall in order to go forward. So what has happened is opponents, his ideological opponents, focus on the rhetoric and not the reality. Mm-hmm. And so he's not a very well understood president, and his accomplishments are vast because we haven't seen stagflation since. You know, it set the stage for Bill Clinton's success. And until Clinton came along, we had very good relations with Russia. It was Clinton that started breaking all the agreements. You may remember the Russians had been promised that NATO would not move one inch to the east. Now it's on their borders. That was Clinton. And we had George W. Bush, who pulled out of the ABM treaty, who rewrote, or his administration rewrote, our nuclear doctrine and took nuclear weapons from being a retaliatory role to a preemptive first strike. And you can see all the things since that we've done to bring threats to Russia. And they have succeeded in, again, creating distrust between the two major nuclear armed powers and restarting the Cold War because it's profitable. When the Soviet Union collapsed, we had to have a new enemy to keep the whole thing going. And so it was the Muslim threat and the war on terror. But this didn't work very good because it was embarrassing that the world's only superpower couldn't deal with a handful of lightly armed jihadists. You know, these wars have gone on now for 15 years to our disadvantage. They were speaking of 30-year wars. So how are you a superpower if you're going to be at war for 30 years against a few thousand lightly armed Taliban or something?
Right.
So they had to get a real enemy again. And of course, Russia was the best target for that, but it also was a target because the Russians under Putin had thrown off the yoke of American supremacy and were asserting an independent foreign policy. And this is a challenge to the neoconservative policy of American world hegemony, you know, which they state very clearly that the primary goal of American foreign policy is to prevent the rise of any country that could serve as a check on American power. So Russia then fit both roles. It was in the way of the neocons program, and it would justify the renewal of massive military spending without being an embarrassment that the United States can't deal with a handful of terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of answers the questions that I brought up to you prior to the interview. How did we get to where we are today? Who's primarily responsible? Of course, we'll get to, before you have to take off, what can we do to correct it, which would be interesting. I just wanted to make mention in that book, The Secrets of the Temple by William Greider. I'm sure you've read that.
Yeah, Greider's book.
Greider, right. He had talked about how during the Carter administration, the economy was actually quite successful versus the popular opinion that Carter was a failure economically. Is that accurate?
Well, it was during the Carter years that the Keynesian demand management policy started breaking down in the sense that those trade-offs between inflation and employment were worsening, you know, that we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't Carter's fault. This was just the fault of the policy. Essentially, what the Keynesian demand management policy did was it pumped up consumer demand with easy money, but it restrained the response of output, of real output, with high tax rates. So it really became more profitable to enterprises just to let the prices rise rather than to invest in increasing output. And this was the fault of the tax policy. I don't think Carter understood that, but nobody else did either, except for a few supply-side economists. I told this whole story in my book that Harvard University published in 1984. It's called The Supply-Side Revolution. You may have seen recently the Chinese have announced that they're now having supply-side reforms. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that they translated and published my book 2 or 3 years ago. So this policy has never been really accepted. It's been demonized too, but now China is taking it up. I think Harvard was quite astonished when they got the request from China to translate and publish the supply-side revolution. But Harvard kept the book in print for decades, which is highly unusual for books to stay in print so long and may still be in print. What the problems are today, they're fundamentally different, the economic problems. Supply-side economics hasn't a solution to American problems today. Our problems today are twofold. One is we have offshored millions of middle-class jobs. This began with manufacturing, and of course it destroyed the unions, but it also destroyed consumer purchasing power. The kind of high productivity, high value added jobs in manufacturing that created a middle class for people without a college education, and which led to rising consumer incomes and rising living standards, that has been given away to China. And it's hurt the tax base of cities and states. And we now see all the kinds of troubles. I mean, look at Detroit, for example. Once a powerhouse of manufacturing is busted. And then corporations found out they could also offshore professional skill jobs that the university-educated kids would move into, you know, like software engineering, information technology, research, design, any kind of engineering that you don't have to be actually on the job present. This work can be done anywhere and sent in on the high-speed internet. So this sort of got rid of the backbone of the American consumer economy. The income that drove the consumer economy, it just ceased to be there. And so you had Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve. What they did, they filled in for the missing growth in real income by expanding credit and got everybody indebted up to the eyeballs. And that's how they kept the economy going in the early part of this century. But once you get indebted and your income's not growing, you can't acquire more debt. And so that whole thing ceased to work. And we know one consequence was the collapse in real estate and in all the financial gimmicks that they had created off of mortgage bonds and the collapse in 2008. Well, there's no real solution to that in terms of policy. You would have to, in some way, bring all those jobs back. But you see the corporations, they benefit from the low-cost labor. It's been the main source of their profits, offshoring of American jobs. So getting them back is probably not going to happen.
It's not in the cards.
It's not in the cards. And then the other problem, which Michael Hudson has demonstrated so clearly, is the economy has been financialized. And what you have now is these huge financial institutions. They are focused on essentially extracting the entire economic surplus into interest payments to themselves. They don't really finance productive activities, factories, or new businesses. They capitalize what economists call economic rents. Well, I'm not going to explain that now, but they capitalize, say, economic surplus into debt instruments that result in the flow of interest to them.
But they're doing God's work, though, right?
They're doing their own work.
So basically what they're God. They're monetizing human beings.
They're basically extracting everything they can into interest payments to serve debt that they issue. This is very unpromising, too. And they're so powerful now, they're too big to fail. And also, they're too big to jail. So what do you do about that? So my view here is that probably we can't do much of anything, and it's going to lead to a collapse. And out of the collapse may come opportunities, but that depends on how the American people see it, if they understand it, if they know what happens. And this is the reason I write. I try to provide understanding of the situation that we're in and how we got there, so that if collapse does occur, if they can't keep this house of cards going, then people will have some idea what really happened and won't fall for whatever the propaganda explanation is. Of course, they'll blame it on China or Putin or something, you know.
Or you.
Or me. No, I'm not important enough. It's China. You know, China will be blamed, or Russia. So that's the economic problem. Now, what's happened to us, Dave, with the Constitution is extremely serious, because the United States is the Constitution. That's what we are. Without the Constitution, we're not the United States. We're some other country.
That's right.
And yet the Constitution has been decimated. All of the protections in the Bill of Rights have been set aside. We now have indefinite detention without presenting any evidence or going before a court. This is what medieval robber barons did. They just picked people up and threw them in the dungeon, and that was it. We have the president also claiming the power to assassinate American citizens without due process of law. That is, they murder on the basis of presumption or assumption. No evidence. The executive branch has violated all of the U.S. statutory laws and international laws against torture, and no one has been held accountable. The executive branch has violated all the laws against spying without warrants, and no one's been held accountable. You can go on and on. Well, what this means is that there's no rule of law. The whole purpose of the rule of law is that it makes law a shield that protects the people from arbitrary government action. If you don't have a rule of law, then you have law not as a shield of the people, but law as a weapon in the hands of the state. And that's what we have now. It's a weapon they use against you. And people should be quite scared about this. Just before she left as the head of the Department of Homeland Security to become chancellor of the University of California, that woman, was her name Janet?
Napolitano, I think.
Napolitano, yes. She said that the focus of Homeland Security had now shifted away from terrorists to domestic extremists.
That would be us.
What is a domestic extremist? Environmentalists, animal rights people, war protesters. And now it's becoming critics of the government. So you no longer see criticism of the government in the mainstream media. So what you see happening here is that the whole notion of a free society and liberty is disappeared. If the government can pick you up and detain you indefinitely, you have no rights. If the government can assassinate you based on suspicion alone, you have no rights. If the government can violate its own laws and commit torture, spying without warrants, you have no rights. If you have no rights, you live in a tyranny. And so that's what is happening to us. This is what my book, How America Was Lost, is about. It's showing the progression from a free nation into a tyranny. Now, people will say, oh, well, they don't bother me. But the point is, if they want to, they can't. Previously, they couldn't, no matter how bad they wanted to. But now, if they want to, they can. And when will they want to? As things get more and more difficult for them, more and more people will fall under these kinds of punishments. Let me say something about the neoconservative threat to world order, because people don't really quite know what that means. This threat is a threat of nuclear war. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the neoconservatives said, hey, look, history has chosen America. It didn't choose the proletariat. It chose American, what they call democratic capitalism. It's neither democratic nor capitalist, but that's what they call it. And it's chosen us to rule the world and to impose our system on everybody else. And this puts us above all law. Law is what we say. It also puts us above the sovereignty of other countries. And this is where the imperial American of the 21st century came from. This is the justification for invading countries on false pretenses, slaughtering huge numbers of people, producing huge numbers of refugees and displaced people. We've done this now to at least 7 countries. It is this notion that we cannot accept any constraint on our will, which has thrown us into conflict with China and Russia. Now, China and Russia is not Iraq and Libya. These are powerful countries. They have powerful militaries, powerful nuclear forces. Trying to force your hegemony by destabilizing these kinds of countries, this is so reckless as to be unbelievable. But that is the foreign policy of the United States. It leads directly to nuclear confrontation. And of course, nobody wins. Or if anybody does, it'll be the Russians because their country is so huge. We're told that we are the exceptional people. We are the indispensable country. These type of claims, what you're telling everybody else is they're expendable. They're unexceptional.
We're the chosen people.
We're the chosen people. And this doesn't work. And the kinds of crazy things that we're doing to provoke Russia, this shows a form of recklessness that is extremely dangerous. And people need to be aware of this. But look, everybody now, oh, Putin this, Putin that. Putin is a corrupt multibillionaire. Putin's new Hitler. Putin's going to invade Poland. He's going to invade the Baltic. I mean, it's endless propaganda. And it's insulting. You can't carry on this type of a show without consequences. So if we're reckless enough to try to take over Ukraine, take over the Russian naval base on the Black Sea in Crimea, we organize a coup in Ukraine, we stick in our guys, we threaten Russia in these ways, this is very, very dangerous. And there's no point to it because the Russians don't express hegemonic aspirations. They're saying, hey, look, let's do business. Let's make a deal. We're here for you. How can we help? And yet they're portrayed throughout the Western print and TV media as some sort of dangerous rogue state ruled by the new Hitler. Well, how do you avoid war when you're so badly led as that? If your political leaders are so incompetent and so stupid and so reckless as to create distrust between the main nuclear powers. This is what Reagan worked to overcome. This was our biggest achievement. We overcame this distrust. He had the agreements, and now they've recreated this distrust. So the whole world's at peril again. If you've read the huge amount of nuclear armaments that we're going to be renewing, some $1 trillion in new nuclear weapons, we don't have any money to pay Medicare or Social Security, and they've got this arms race going again. Well, who benefits? Well, the armaments industries, the clandestine agencies, and everyone else is at the risk of nuclear war. So I'd like to end on that note because this is a very serious situation. It's the most serious situation of my lifetime. The Cold War was never as dangerous as what has been created now.
Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, sir, I appreciate the time you have spent explaining all this to listeners, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to it, David, and appreciate your sharing your audience with me.